Hello, this is Curtis Edwards, Vice President of Investor Relations at Hudson Investing. Are you ready to start building your multifamily portfolio? Kent and I are excited to announce our newest deal in Spartanburg, South Carolina. This 157-unit property offers a unique chance to acquire a B-class value-add property for just $120,000 per door. This is well below replacement costs. De-risking the deal even further is a favorable loan assumption with over 6 years remaining at 3.73% fixed. With 50 economic development projects underway and 70,000 jobs within a 20-minute drive, the South Carolina Upstate region is primed for above-average job, population, and rent growth. Don't miss out on this exclusive deal. Find the link in the description notes to learn how you can invest.
It would be a question, but it's also a test. It's all about communication for me. Or if they're not answering me before I wire the money, there's no way they're going to answer me after I've wired the money. So what I do is I look at the pitch deck. I analyze it. We have a deal analyzer that I use at Left Field Investors, and it kind of throws up some red flags. I'll ask those questions through an email, and then I'll see if they're going to respond. If they don't respond within 24 hours or give a reason why they couldn't, then I'm probably not going to invest.
Welcome to Right Around Real Estate, the show about how to passively invest like a pro. On each episode, I interview real estate experts who give their top investing advice, strategies, and tools, and I break down their insights into practical steps to avoid the pitfalls and make better investments. I want to help you passively invest like a pro. This is Right Around Real Estate, and I'm your host, Kent Ritter. Hello, fellow investors. Welcome to another episode of Right Around Real Estate. We teach you how to passively invest like a pro. Today, I've got a very special episode. Got two guests, so two for one deal. And we have Jim Pfeiffer, one of the founders of Left Field Investors. And we're going to learn from him how his group is adding value to the LP investor community. And then we've got Paul Shannon. Paul and I go back quite a ways. And Paul is founder of Red Hawk Real Estate. And Red Hawk is doing a bunch of different things, including partnering with Left Field in what I think is a pretty unique model. And so I wanted to bring them on the show today, wanted to let you guys hear about it. I think there's some people out there that they can definitely add value to. So I'm excited to get started, and we'll start at the top like we always do. And let's start with you, Jim. Tell me a little bit about who you are and how you got to where you are today.
Sure. Well, I'm on career, I think, number six. So I'm not going to go through all of it, but I was a finance major in college, then got a job in business, then was a financial services teacher in high school. And then I went on to become a financial advisor. And that's where the story really starts, because when I was a financial advisor, you know, I thought I knew everything there was to know about money and financial markets. And but they retrain you. They teach you about money. And at the same time I was learning about money the new way from the financial advising company, I was an accidental landlord because we couldn't sell our house in 2008 when we moved. So we had to rent it out. And I did not like being a landlord, but I loved having a rental. And as I was learning about money, they were teaching me all this stuff about paper assets. But I was learning on the side about real estate, real assets. And so I really learned the difference between speculation, which to me is paper assets, because you're investing in a piece of paper, you hold it long enough, and you hope you can sell it to somebody for more later, and there's no current benefit. While the real assets, the real estate, you're getting a current benefit in cash flow or income, and then the appreciation is just kind of the gravy, right? But you get it generally. And so that really taught me over, you know, it took me a while. I started buying more and more real estate. After about 7 years, I said, I can't do financial advising anymore, because I was putting all my money into real estate and I couldn't tell my clients, hey, put your money in paper. I'm going to put mine in real assets. So I left and I became a full-time active investor. And I wasn't a good asset manager, right? But I was fortunate that it was during the time when everything went up. So I made a lot of money, but not because I was doing anything right. And at that time, I realized I found passive investing, and I realized I could hire professional asset managers like Paul, and they would manage the asset for me. And so all my work I had to do was vet the operator, find the deals and all that. And then I would just make the money as a passive investor. And that's when I found that's what I wanted to do. And Left Field Investors came about because I wanted a small mastermind of 12 people just to talk about passive investing, because you can't go to your neighbors and say, hey, let's talk about syndication investing, right? If they talk about personal finance, it's 401k, IRA, you say syndication, they look at you like you're nuts. Mm-hmm. So we started Left Field Investors, a small mastermind. It's a pandemic baby. Our first meeting was canceled because the world closed down, and that sent us online. And online is what grew our community. We spent the first year trying to restrict the number of people, but there was so much interest because we wanted a small mastermind. There was so much interest. It just grew. We put a website together, and now, you know, we have 1,800 members. We do several webinars a week. We provide education. We provide a network, and we provide some deal flow to our community members. So that's, in a nutshell, that's my journey, and that's what Left Field Investors is all about.
Gotcha. No, I love that. I mean, finding your strength, kind of doubling down on the strength, you know, creating a community around that and being able to find other sponsors, and now creating education and deal flow for passive investors. So I think just well aligned with your vision and what you guys have set out to do. So love hearing about that. I think that's a really unique offering out there. So thanks for sharing, Jim. And Paul, let's give you a chance at bat here. Tell us a little about, you know, who you are and where you came from and how you got to be where you are today.
Thanks, Kent. Appreciate the opportunity to be on the show today. So my background is in sales. I was in corporate America sales for 15 years. The last decade or so, I was in medical device and capital equipment sales. And I was implementing all the surgical equipment that's used for cataract surgery. So all the devices, the equipment, the implants, the disposable materials, and kind of training surgical staff on how to use that stuff, as well as the surgeon on how to implement this technology. And then got into implementing some more difficult technologies into health systems and more on the administrative side. So a lot of travel, a lot of early mornings, a lot of hours. And there was a point in time where I realized I didn't necessarily want my boss's job anymore. And that had always been the case. I was always kind of looking for that next promotion. And I had started investing in real estate because I was interested in alternative income streams and kind of diversifying away from my W-2. Maybe a little bit interested in financial freedom, if you will, and kind of retiring early, but hadn't quite made that leap yet to getting to that mindset. So had started in single family, like a lot of real estate investors do, bought a property at auction that needed quite a bit of renovations, and really just dove in, had pretty much every issue that you could think of come up with, you know, contractors, you know, staying at the house late and partying overnight, shoddy craftsman work, under budgeting for some of the renovation that needed to happen, and not really understanding, you know, plumbing, electrical, and all these issues. So, but to, you know, as Jim had pointed out, you know, when the market is rising, you know, all ships are going up in the tide. So was fortunate enough to come out the other side and still wanted to move forward. So continued to kind of grow through that process, and was really using the BRRRR strategy. So buying, renovating, renting out, refinancing, and then repeating. And as my portfolio started to grow, I realized that the only thing that was really holding me back from scaling this bigger was the career that I was in and just the time that I was putting into it. So in early 2019, I decided to make the leap and go full-time into real estate. And that's when we really started to scale things up. I acquired about 25 properties that year, got into multifamily the next year, and just started to kind of work my way through things. And was always in that sort of BRRRR mentality of trying to recycle my capital, thinking that I had sort of a finite amount of money and that I wanted to put it into the asset, improve the quality of it, improve the value of it, and then refinance that capital out and keep going. So we did that all the way through COVID, even during the beginning parts of COVID. And then it was about 2021 or so, end of the year, beginning of 2022, where, you know, transitory inflation started to lose its sort of believability, if you will. So you had inflation running at about 9%. You had the 10-year treasury at maybe, you know, 50 basis points. And you had Jerome Powell telling us that we're going to be raising rates here in the short term. So we started to look at what we needed to do to underwrite multifamily assets at that time and actually be awarded the deal. And you had to use bridge debt. You had to use floating rates. You had to use higher leverage. And all these things seemed a little bit out of balance from a risk perspective. So we never put our pencils down. We were aggressively underwriting a lot of deals and trying to build relationships. But when you're underwriting to, you know, 5-year, 7-year step down prepays with agency debt and funding your CapEx by raising the money through your LPs versus borrowing it from the bank, and your debt service coverage restrained because you're not borrowing on a pro forma, you're borrowing on actuals, Inherently, your leverage is going to be lower, and what you're able to pay for a property is going to be restricted. So we were coming in at, you know, 80 to 85% of guidance on a lot of these deals, you know, shaking our heads at who was buying this stuff, and kind of were getting frustrated. Backing up a little bit, I started investing passively in real estate in 2017. And some of it's in multifamily and geographies that I'm not actively involved in. So I can get some of the benefits of, let's say, the Sun Belt, where you've got a lot of population moving there and migration happening, and the appreciation that's happening in those markets versus a steady eddy cash flow market like Indianapolis, for example, where I live. And some of it was in other asset classes where I thought there were benefits to diversify into triple net leases, into retail, industrial, mixed use development, notes, et cetera, et cetera. So I didn't have the core competencies to operate myself actively in those types of assets, but just networking and meeting other sponsors and kind of expanding my network enabled me to kind of diversify my passive investing portfolio, my real estate portfolio overall. So that brings us up to today. I have some experience on both the passive and active side. Saw there was an opportunity in the marketplace really to help LPs. You know, right now there's sort of a reluctance on a lot of LPs behalf to place capital in some of these deals. They maybe had distributions paused or had capital calls and are, you know, feeling a little less wealthy when the stock market's kind of going up and down and not just booming. So it's a little bit harder to raise money for sponsors, as you're probably aware. So sponsors are more willing to create, you know, flexible opportunities or flexible terms. And if we can come in as a fund, InvestWise Collective, and negotiate better terms with sponsors and be sort of a streamlined capital source for them, instead of going to 20 LPs and raising $50,000 from each to get to $1 million, maybe we can bring $1 million in. And instead of getting a, you know, 70-30 promote, we might get an 80-20. We can pass some of those terms on to LPs. We can vet these deals and kind of provide curated opportunities that we think provide asymmetric risk profiles, get them better terms and help them in that sense, but also help the sponsors as well with kind of an awkward check size appealing to these retail investors, maybe that are, we're going to probably raise between 500,000 to 2 million per deal. So that's kind of the maturity of this whole process and this, the InvestWise Collective being born.
Okay. Yeah. And I want to dig into all that. We'll kind of get there. You can explain what InvestWise is. And I do think it's a unique model. Before we go there though, I want to go back to Jim. I want to understand, you know, talk a little bit about, you shared with what Left Field Investors is, right? It was meant to be a group of 12. Clearly there was a large appetite for folks wanting to figure out how to invest in, let's call it alternative assets, or maybe it was specifically real estate, but wanting to do something different than what they had traditionally done with the 401k and these things that we know just don't work long-term. So there's that appetite there. It grows rapidly during COVID. Now you guys have this 1800 person base. I'm curious because you probably have a unique perspective on investor appetite and investor sentiment. And so I'm curious right now, you know, Paul alluded to a couple things, but just in general, how have you seen the investor sentiment, investor tone change over, let's say, the past, you know, year now, as we're going into probably about a year ago when things started really changing in the world. So how, give me the pulse of investors right now.
Yeah, that's a great question because it has changed considerably, right? Last year or 18 months ago, is really when we started presenting deals to our community through what we call deal webinars, right? So an operator will come and present a deal to our community, and then our community, the members will decide whether they want to invest or not. Mm-hmm. And man, those first few deals that we did, and actually all throughout the summer of last year, we couldn't give enough deals, right? There, and every deal was really well received, and people were really committing capital because they were just used to everything going 2 or 3 years and then flipping and getting your cash back, right? Everything was just accelerated. Returns were great. The velocity of money was great and everything was just humming along. And then the interest rate change, the hike in interest rate, it wasn't necessarily that we went, you know, from low to high. It's the pace of change that really threw everything off, I think. And all that economic uncertainty, what we've seen now is we still have members that are allocating capital, but they're much more patient. They're much more cautious. They are, you know, before, like last year, we could present them an opportunity from an operator that maybe they'd never heard of, but that hour long webinar and maybe some follow-up questions, that was enough to get them comfortable enough to invest. Now we're seeing they're not investing unless they know the operator. So we have operators that'll come up to us and say, "Hey, I want to present a deal webinar." And, you know, we'll say, "Look, you can if you want, but they don't know you. It's not going to be successful." And I think some of the operators are used to everyone investing in their deals from, you know, the past few years. So they kind of don't believe it. And then they present, and some of those just aren't seeing success, while the operators that are well-known in our community, they're still having success, but less, right? So for example, last year, one of the operators we do a lot with had a fund, and our community invested, $3 million in the fund. This year, they started another fund, and our community, I think, was about half that. And, you know, and our community has been growing. So people are just a lot more cautious. They're kind of sitting on capital, and they're reluctant to jump in, especially if they're not familiar with the operator. That's been our experience.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think that's similar to our own experience as we go out and raise capital in this environment. I think people are generally more cautious. So define for me now, what is it that your investors are looking for in the deals where they do deploy capital? What are the things, you know, we understand kind of comfort with the sponsor, but are there things, whether it's geography, whether it's certain return criteria that where you're seeing money flow to deals at this point?
Yeah, it's, I don't want to emphasize it too much. It really, a lot of it focuses on the operator. But as far as once you get into the deal, then they're really looking at things like the debt, right? As Paul talked about, you know, the adjustable rate debt, bridge debt, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. People are making sure that they have, you know, adequate rate caps or fixed debt, or just they're looking closer at the terms. They are also just more cautious in general. So if you're changing asset classes, they might back off a little bit, where before they might just jump into it. They're looking for deals that have something unique about them, meaning it's not just the standard multifamily deal with the same terms as everybody else, but maybe someone's buying a distressed asset or something that gives them, there's some tax advantage deals that give them advantages and extra equity right out of the gate. So they're looking for kind of just something that gives the deal an advantage over, you know, last year it was every deal was, you know, you could find capital anywhere. Now it's, there has to be something special about your deal or your asset class or your approach that is going to make the difference for the LP investors.
Interesting.
And I would add to that too. One of the things that I'm hearing and I'm seeing is that, you know, there's a lot of competition now from other assets, other alternatives, even bonds. With interest rates rising, that's actually helped certain types of investors, fixed income investors, for example, where you can get a risk-free rate of return with a 10-year treasury of 4.3% today. You can get 5% in a high-yield savings account. You can get 6% plus in triple B rated bonds. So if you compare that to a multifamily asset that doesn't pay cash flow on the front, that maybe has an 18-month business plan that then will pay you a 6% cash on cash return, you kind of have to compare that to the other available alternatives in the market. And if it's not an attractive risk profile, there's not a premium, a risk premium, because inherently commercial real estate, multifamily, whatever it is going to be more risky than a risk-free option. Mm-hmm. Then I don't think investors are willing to step out on that ledge and take that additional risk unless they're being compensated for it.
Yeah. And I would also add, sorry to interrupt, but I would add that debt is becoming more interesting to our community, where, you know, they're willing to forgo the upside of an equity investment as long as they can get, you know, a debt deal between 6% and 10%. And it's interesting to me that, you know, even private lending, which I do, you know, interest rates have risen, but the private lending money that, you know, I'm not getting that much more interest paid to me in private lending deals than I used to. And the debt deals that we see at syndicated debt deals, you're not getting higher interest rates paid to you than you were a couple of years ago. But all of those types of deals are becoming more attractive because, you know, there's an easier exit and it's a little less risky.
Interesting. Yeah, interesting. You see, you sit higher on the capital stack, it could be a little less risky. I mean, it sounds to me like investors are in general becoming better investors. They're paying attention to the things they should be paying attention to. So I think there's, you know, that's the benefit, I think, that comes from, let's call it, pullbacks like this, where people actually have to really understand what they're getting into. I think that's great. I mean, people are focusing on debt. Good. It's 50 to 75% of the capital stack. You should be paying attention to it. So I think, yeah. I think that's a benefit of kind of what's going on right now, is I think while a lot of people are sitting on the sidelines, the ones that are active, I think, are really understanding the nuances of what really drives deals beyond real estate just always goes up. Right. And yeah, Paul, the only thing I'd have to say, I don't agree that you can compare real estate to a savings account or a bond. I think it's apples and oranges, and, you know, everybody has different opinions, but like, if you tell me you're going to invest in a 5% savings account instead of a real estate deal, it's okay. But understand that, I mean, a lot of our people are in a 40% tax bracket. So 5 becomes 3 pretty quickly on your return because you have to pay taxes. And then as you think about where, you know, what drives those interest rates, it's not like the banks are doing us a favor, right? You know, and as soon as SOFR comes down, the first lever that the Fed will pull, right, will be short-term rates, and those rates will come down. And there's an opportunity cost there. There's like, if the 3% might feel good and safe in for the next 6 months or a year, but there's the opportunity cost, and now you're, you know, maybe you're back to 1%. And, you know, I get it. I've heard the argument, but to me, it's just the apples and oranges. I mean, I don't believe everybody should have all their money in real estate, but I definitely don't think it's a savings account is the solution really at any time. But, you know, personal opinions aside, I just think you gotta stay diversified. You just have to be smarter about how you look at it. I just don't think pulling back is, you know, in kind of these quote unquote risk-free things is the answer. I think it's get better at investing, learn more, you know, talk about debt, understand things. I don't know. I guess I say that because I've been having a lot of those conversations lately. It's like, well, I can get 5% in a savings account. It's like, yeah, but you gotta really dig deeper into what that means. And is it really 5%? And usually it's not, but
yeah, all that being said, every investor has a different criteria and investment philosophy, and, you know, risk tolerance, I think, is really what it comes down to, and what they're willing to accept. I think diversification is important. I mean, I'm heavily invested in real estate in my portfolio as a whole, but, you know, at the end of the day, interest rates and cap rates are very heavily correlated, right? They may not be 100% correlated. There's, you know, a lot of complexities to the macroeconomic landscape. But when interest rates are super low and cap rates, let's say if interest rates are 3% and cap rates are 6%, there's a nice delta there. But if interest rates are 6% and cap rates are 5%, you know, you're probably using negative leverage to acquire assets. And typically that's where underwriting can stop for the most part. I mean, that's not entirely true, but if you're just doing back of the napkin analysis, it's difficult to see where, you know, the upside is with an asset like that. And then you have to think about the fact that there's a little bit of a lag right now. There's still a gap in the bid and the ask in a lot of these potential transactions that aren't happening. So if cap rates expand further, that's obviously going to put pressure on the pricing. So if you're going to come in and you're going to acquire assets, you want to make sure that you've got somewhat of an insurance policy. I like to think of it as a preservation of principle. If cap rates do expand, am I buying at a good enough basis? Am I adding enough value that my stabilized yield when I'm finished with my business plan, is it going to be comfortably above the market cap rate and ideally above that terminal cap rate? So you want to kind of make an assumption that worst case scenario, that terminal cap rate may move up because interest rates have been moving up and they maybe haven't caught up quite yet. So that's just a, you know, a personal kind of philosophy or risk tolerance. And I'm more of a singles and doubles guy than I am swinging for the fences and just like to remain conservative. Because to me, it's all about staying in the game long term and not getting crushed, which I think you can do if you're not prudent. So,
sure, absolutely. Okay, well, let's talk about. We understand left field. You guys have come together to partner in a unique way, and I think that's what we're really here to talk about today. So let's talk a little bit about the InvestWise Collective, and, you know, what is the InvestWise Collective, and what kind of benefit is that going to provide to investors?
Yeah, so InvestWise Collective is a partnership between my firm, Red Hawk Real Estate, and the Left Field Investors. And it's a customizable fund. It's really asset class agnostic. So we're looking for, you know, when I say that, it could be debt, it could be equity, it could be, you know, triple net, sale leaseback deals with industrial properties, it could be retail properties, it could be multifamily properties. So we're kind of taking an anti-niche approach. And what we're really looking for is kind of what we just talked about. I mean, we're looking for deals that have solid risk premiums where we feel we're being compensated for the risk we're taking above the risk-free rate. We're looking for a stabilized yield above the market cap rate and above the terminal cap rate so we can actually know that we're adding value and we're going to make a profit in the deal. And essentially what that boils down to is an asymmetric risk profile. So we're trying to sort of imbalance the scales. If you think about risk and return, typically as risk goes up, so should follow returns. You should be getting paid for the risk you're taking. As risk goes down, your returns will go down. We want to find scenarios where maybe the returns go up a little bit, but the risk doesn't go up a little bit. So we're kind of imbalancing that a little bit and creating that asymmetric risk profile. So with a customizable fund, we are a little bit different than what maybe investors are used to with funds. And a lot of people are familiar with blind pool or semi-blind pool funds where maybe I'm the operator and I say, hey, we're buying into multifamily assets in the Sun Belt that are 100 units plus that were built 1980s and later that have XYZ criteria or physical characteristics. You as the limited partner might buy into that thesis and want to diversify amongst the spread of assets. So you wire the funds to me, the operator, and then I go shopping for anything that falls within that buy box. And then we acquire and acquire and acquire. So that's a semi-blind pool fund. With a customizable fund, I shared with you our thesis. We're kind of looking at all asset classes and looking for yield and good opportunity, trying to diversify within the fund itself based on risk tolerance, cash flow versus appreciation, geographic areas, diversify amongst sponsors. So we want to make it well-rounded. But at the same time, if you're an individual LP investor and you decide, you know what, for me, development isn't something I'm interested in. So I don't want to, you know, I'm more of a cash flow investor. So I'm not going to invest in this particular deal we're bringing into the fund. You have that choice. You're kind of the fourth manager, if you will. We have three fund managers on our team. The individual investor, we consider the fourth manager. They have right of refusal on that deal. So they don't have to participate. So come the end of the year and come tax time, when they get their K-1, they're going to get a single K-1. And let's say in 2 years, we have 10 assets in the fund. This individual investor has only invested in 5 deals. Their K-1 will only represent their positions that they're invested in. They will only get reporting on the 5 out of the 10 deals that they're involved in. So it's kind of a streamlined way of creating that diversification. It gets another set of eyes on the deal. We're not registered investment advisors. We're not making recommendations, but we're guys that are looking to allocate capital that maybe do have some cash sitting in high yield savings accounts that are ready to put it in play. We want to find the best opportunities that we can for our capital. And if we find something, all three of us have to agree. And then we basically say, listen, you as the fourth manager, Mr. Investor, Mrs. Investor, come along with us if you'd like. Here's the vehicle to do it in this fund. The three of us are investing in this deal. And we've negotiated better terms with the sponsor because we're streamlining their capital source instead of, you know, having to go to 20 investors for $1 million and make 100 phone calls. We take the burden off and we write the $1 million check and they can focus on operation, which is what we want to have as LPs anyways. We want that real estate operator focused on executing the business plan and, you know, getting the deal done, not on scrambling around for capital and marketing all day. So I think we offer kind of a resource on both sides of the table. And it's an opportunistic time to make this play with, you know, GPs having a little bit more of a challenge in raising the capital, LPs looking for a little bit more, vetting and handholding, if you will. So if we can marry those two together and provide a, you know, value add to both sides, no pun intended, we think we have something here and we'll be successful.
Gotcha. So are you guys doing, I guess, is Red Hawk, are you managing these? You're not managing the deals. You are just going to be vetting other sponsors?
Correct. We are not asset managers. We are taking an LP position in all the deals that we invest in.
Gotcha. So the value prop here is you guys are finding other sponsors. So you're creating deal flow. And I guess that's the connection with Left Field, perhaps. So this is a subset of Left Field that is, or how do the two entities relate to each other?
Yeah, it's a partnership. So, you know, Left Field Investors, we're kind of a do-it-yourself community, right? We're trying to turn community into a verb. So when we look at a deal as a community, we're going to community the deal, meaning we're going to analyze it together. We're going to community the sponsor, meaning we're going to vet them together. So when we do a typical deal webinar, you know, we don't take a cut of that. We're not GPs at all. We just we allow the sponsor to present the deal. And then in our private forums, people will talk about it and decide on their own whether they're going to invest. Now, InvestWise Collective is kind of a step beyond that, because now we're having the three fund principals are looking at the deals, they're analyzing the deals, and they're deciding, yes, this is going to go in the fund. And it's still going to be up to the individual, you know, LPs, whether they want to invest in that, as Paul said, but it's a little bit more curated, I would say, because as gotcha. Paul said, we're not recommending deals, but we the InvestWise Collective is curating them.
Not okay. So this is a, you have sponsors come to Left Field, then there's a subset that get picked to be in this fund based on Paul and sounds like two other managers. And then from there, folks in Left Field can participate. I guess it's not a recommendation, it's a curation, but it's a, I'm just trying to understand how the pieces come together here, I guess, as it.
I'll let Paul answer that, but just
getting it the right way.
Yeah. And InvestWise Collective stands on its own. It's a partnership between Left Field and Red Hawk, but it is its own entity. So it's not just for Left Field investors. It's for anyone who is interested as an LP to join in and work with Paul, but I'll let Paul explain kind of how it works a little bit better.
Gotcha.
No, we've touched on a lot of it. I think that, you know, Left Field Investors has experience and has track record of investing with certain sponsors. They have obviously a large sponsor network, some of which have presented, but maybe haven't, you know, had Left Field Investors join in on their deals.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of folks in Jim's community. There's 1,400 members. Is that about right, Jim?
We're up to 1,800 now. Yep.
Oh, wow. Okay. Awesome. So obviously that's a fantastic, you know, group of people that are educated on how to invest in syndicated deals as limited partners. Some are learning, some are more experienced, but we are definitely interested in, you know, working with sponsors that community has familiarity with. Now, I've got some relationships with sponsors that are outside of the community, either that I've invested with myself that are not a part of the Left Field community, or they are people that I have networked with and met at conferences, at, you know, meetups, similar to how you and I met, and you know, can kind of connect the dots on some of these things that, you know, and introduce them into the fold in the Left Field investing community. And then, you know, frankly, we're trying to build relationships with new sponsors as well. There's a lot of sponsors that don't necessarily do the best job of marketing, right? They don't put themselves out there. They're not on LinkedIn. They're not doing podcasts. They're just real estate guys. They've been doing it for 20 years, 30 years. Maybe they just work with a few select wealthy individuals or families, right? Mm-hmm. Those are people we're definitely interested in working with that have been through market cycles that, you know, just want to focus on getting the deal done and operating the real estate and not on raising capital and trying to create, you know, a brand essentially. So we're actively looking for those types of folks. And when we do introduce those types of people into the fold, it'll be through a more heavily vetted process, you know, background checks, and let's look at multiple deals. We're not committing to the first thing that comes into our inbox as far as underwriting goes. It's, you know, a process to kind of build that trust. And mm-hmm. I think Jim alluded to it earlier in the podcast that betting on put a different way, betting on the jockey is more important than the horse. So you have to be comfortable with the sponsor. Can you trust them with your capital? Are they a fiduciary, a steward of your capital? Do they have the resources, the team in place to execute their business plan that they have on paper? You know, and then it gets down to the deal level. So with that, you know, relationships take time, trust building takes time, but we hope to introduce additional sponsors into the mix as well.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you guys. Appreciate it. Good understanding of the process now. So you guys are bringing in, using your experience and network, bringing in sponsors, providing a little more vetting on the front end, kind of putting your stamp of approval on specific sponsors. And then there's value there, right? Especially for the, because I 100% agree with you that the sponsor is more important than the deal. And going back to my own experience of having one of my first investments, had the sponsor commit fraud, and I still don't have that money back. I don't think it's ever coming back. It's still floating around out there somewhere. But that was my lesson learned. Sponsors absolutely matter. So you guys are providing that background, that service, putting your lens to it. And then it sounded like also negotiating preferred returns on top of what an LP may be able to get individually. So talk to me a little bit about that. What does that look like for an LP?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you come into a deal as a limited partner and you write a, you know, the deal minimum is $25,000 or $50,000, you're getting what is advertised as the pro forma returns on the OM. So it mm-hmm. might be, you know, today a 6% cash on cash, maybe it's a 7% preferred return, could be a, you know, 70-30 split. And then, you know, our idea is that we're going to, as mentioned, kind of streamline the capital. So if we can bring a larger check to, you know, a deal, and these have got to be the right size deals, of course, right? So if we're talking about a $30 million deal and they need $15 million in equity and we can bring them $1 million, we're not expecting to get better terms. Mm-hmm. That's not a meaningful check size to that particular operator in that deal. But if it's, let's say, you know, a $5 million deal and, you know, the operator needs a $3 million check and maybe they've got $1 million committed from a family office or something and they need that extra boost, they don't have as much pull with their retail investors at the moment. Maybe we can write that $1 million check. And through that, you know, they'll be willing to offer us a slightly better term. So instead of that 70-30 promote, we might get an 80-20, or we might get a, you know, an extra percentage point on the preferred return. And we can take that extra benefit and pass that on to our investors while also, you know, leaving a little bit of room for the fund to perform if the deal performs. One of the biggest things about this fund and the mantra, I think, of LFI as well as InvestWise Collective is aligning interests. So we really want to make sure that every deal we do aligns interests with our limited partners and we're putting them first. It's honestly less about money and more about let's get this right and make sure it's transparent and everybody understands what the risks are, understands where this might fit in their portfolio, understands who this might be for and who it might not be for. That's where the investor can opt out of the customizable fund. So that's kind of the approach. And then I'd say the second layer to that is access. There are some deals that are larger, or there are other funds potentially on the debt side that we might look at investing in where, you know, the minimums are $500,000. Well, most limited partners are not in a position to write that check size. So if we can come in and we can aggregate together as a community or as a fund and bring that check to that sponsor, well, now they get access to institutional quality deals or deals that they wouldn't otherwise have access to. So that's also a value add of the fund.
Gotcha. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, it's definitely unique. I love the idea of the customizable fund. I love the idea of being able to opt in and opt out. I mean, really, it sounds like similarly to what you do if you're looking at things on an individual deal perspective. But as you said, a little more streamlined. So I think it's unique. That's why I wanted to have you guys on. I hadn't heard of it before. So great innovation, I would say, and excited to see where you guys go with it. But yeah, definitely. And I can, you know, you see the need. I mean, you're right. In the market right now, there are absolutely sponsors out there who are struggling to raise capital. It sounds like you guys, as you said, can be a little opportunistic and provide some value there and maybe secure some better returns for your investors as well. So yeah, like it. Really interesting. Excited to see how it grows over the next couple of years with you guys. So before I let you go, I want to take you guys through our keys to success round. We say ask the same four questions to everybody. I'll let you guys both take a bite at the apple here because I think you're smart guys. I want to hear your perspective. The first one is, if you were going to invest with a sponsor, right up your alley, and you could only ask them one question, you don't know anything about the deal, what would the one question be?
I guess I'll go first since I spoke up first. It would be a question, but it's also a test. It's all about communication for me. I want to know how they communicate. So what I do is I test them. How reliable are they to respond in a timely fashion with a quality answers? And I want to know that before I wire the money, because if I wire the money, if they're not answering me before I wire the money, there's no way they're going to answer me after I've wired the money. So what I do is I look at the pitch deck, I analyze it. We have a deal analyzer that I use at Left Field Investors, and it kind of throws up some red flags. I'll ask those questions through an email, and then I'll see if they're going to respond. If they don't respond within 24 hours or give a reason why they couldn't, then I'm probably not going to invest. And then when they do respond, I'm going to see what quality answer it is. If they say, hey, we just did a webinar, go check that out, then I'm probably not going to invest with them because I want to know that they're willing to answer my questions. And once they do answer, I'll probably ask some follow-up questions, even if I don't have any more questions, just to see if they're going to put up with me asking and wanting information. And if they're not, I'm going to move on. There's plenty of operators out there, but I want to make sure that they communicate effectively with me. So that question is going to be, how do you communicate? Do you do it in a quality way?
Interesting. All right. That's interesting. I don't know if I've heard that one before. So the 24-hour response and then the follow-up and making sure they're willing to put the effort in on the front end, because that's going to show if they're going to be responsive on the back end. Yeah. All right. I like it.
I've had some experiences where I didn't do that and they were bad at communicating. And it does not matter to me whether you're going to give me, you know, 2x return in 2 years or you lose my money. If you're not communicating with me on either one of those, I'm going to be frustrated and upset. And as a passive investor, I have no control, long-term illiquid deals. I want to know, hey, what's going on? And so information is key for me.
Well, it makes sense. I think you also know what's important to you and communication is very important. So yeah, I like it. How about you, Paul?
Great answer, Jim. Tough the top. Mine would be more deal driven. And I think it can relate back to building trust as well. I would ask for their underwriting. You know, some people are reluctant to send over their spreadsheet. And to me, that's an immediate red flag. It's like, what are you hiding? Like, I can see your OM. I can see what you put on a flashy marketing flyer, but let me drill into the numbers a little bit deeper than that. So if I can't see it, I get a little turned off. And as a fund, obviously, that's a mandatory requirement. But I think individual limited partners should get into it as well, even if they're just wiring 25,000, because number one, it makes you a better passive investor to see that underwriting and kind of understand, digest it. And you can see how the operator looks at risks based on their assumptions. We're not really focused at the fund level on output or pro forma projections. We're focused on the inputs. Like, is that rent growth projection accurate? What do the comps look like in the area? What are they asking right now? You know, how much vacancy do they have? And if we can, you know, drill down into those inputs and understand those better, it really exposes a lot as far as what risks the operator is taking. So I'd encourage all LPs to ask that question. If you can't get it, you know, I'm not sure what to say about that. That just doesn't make a lot of sense to me as to why an underwriter or why an operator wouldn't share that information. If they're worried about it being a proprietary spreadsheet, you can always use a tool like Red IQ and block all the ability to edit it and change it and send it on. Or you can just send it in like a PDF format. So to me, it should be something that should be pretty easy to do if you're the GP.
Hmm. Yeah, good answer. Totally different side of the fence, but also very valuable. And Paul, you are the numbers guy for sure. So understand digging in and understanding that. I love your point about the inputs versus the outputs, because I think that's so critical. There's a handful, 4 or 5 assumptions that really drive majority of the changes in your return profile, right? And I think understanding those and validating those assumptions is what is absolutely critical. So, all right, good on, guys. Next question, Jim, we'll go with you first. What are you most proud of in your career?
I think the thing I'm most proud is creating a community of left field investors, that we're helping LPs become better investors. We're helping them educate. No one has learned more since Left Field Investors began than I have. So I'm very grateful for that. But, you know, there aren't very many places you can go to learn about this. If you turn on the TV, you're going to see advertisements for Wall Street. As I said, you talk to your neighbors, it's going to be paper assets. Where do people go to learn about this? They just listen to podcasts and go to the internet. Well, now you can have a community, you can have a network, you can talk to other people. And so that's absolutely the thing I'm most proud of is not only helping people that are already into it, but getting new people into it, getting people who didn't think, hey, I put money in my 401k, but I don't even know what this real estate thing is. Well, now they have a place to go to learn so they can become passive investors and, you know, create financial freedom for their family. So that's what I'm most proud of.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that education is a much needed service. Like you said, there isn't a lot of places to find it. That was one of the reasons I started the podcast back in COVID, was because I learned about this thing, and it was the same thing. Like you said, I went and I talked to my, I started investing in syndications back in 2014, and you talk to your friends about it and they're like, what? And I have no idea. Yeah. Right.
Right.
So there's nobody to talk to. And so that was kind of the same thing for me. I realized, man, I mean, I'm making fantastic returns, but literally nobody knows about this. And yeah, there's nobody to talk to professionally, really, because you talk to your financial advisor and they tell you that you should be in a REIT. Or another great one I just heard recently was, you have too much real estate exposure because you own your own home. I was like, well, that's a new one. But, yeah. But anyway, just this idea that there's sorely needed education in this space. So I think definitely a valuable service there. And Paul, how about you?
I'm most proud of kind of changing my definition of what career actually means, to be honest. I used to be in a role where, you know, I had a decent compensation package. I kind of had the bird in the hand. I was unsatisfied with my day-to-day and, you know, get the Sunday blues, et cetera, et cetera. And it went on for years. And I just had a very low risk tolerance and, you know, kind of thought, well, I'm not the kind of guy that can make that leap to do something new and try something new. So when I finally did, you know, I stopped thinking about the 4% rule and drawing down my principal and having to have enough in my nest egg to last for 30, 40 years, because I eventually did want to retire early. And instead, I started thinking about what are the possibilities. You know, I enjoyed real estate. I actually enjoyed my day-to-day. I wanted to grow. I wanted to learn. I wanted to try new things, transition from asset classes and, you know, try property management, operations, asset management, underwriting. So I just love it. I have a real passion for it. And now, you know, making that transition, it's just empowering. Like, I feel like I don't ever want to retire. I look at this as a career now that I can do, you know, until the day I die, because it's that interesting to me. So, you know, for me, it's also, you know, I'm proud of it because I see a lot of people that are in the position that I was in maybe 6-7 years ago, stuck in that place and not really knowing how to make the move. And it really just starts with taking that first step and then continuing to grow and walking down the path. And eventually, you know, you can read so many books and you can theorize and you can plan out all the worst case scenarios, but you have to make the leap and you have to believe in yourself. And thankfully I had the support of my family to do it. So that would be my answer, is just changing the way that I think about career. It's not something you have to do to your 65 and be miserable. You can do something you love and grow into it. And, you know, the money will follow. So.
Yeah. One, I applaud you for that, for taking that leap, because that is not something most people can do. And that's why most people are stuck where they are. And two, I think you're an awesome example to those people who are currently stuck, that they don't have to be. You can do it, right? And it seems like the resources you guys are providing could be a baby step to help people get there too. So, I mean, I think that's great. I just, you know, I want to live in a world where more people are financially secure, because I think those people are going to be happier and they're going to be doing what they want to do. And they're ultimately going to be more productive. And I think at scale that it creates meaningful change. So I think you're one example of that, Paul. So fantastic.
Thanks, Ken.
Yeah. Well, let's get to, what is a book that everybody should read?
The one that I'm going to say, it's not out yet, but it's coming soon. And I read an advanced copy last week. It's called Avoiding Rookie Errors as a Left Fielder. And it's written by one of the founders of LFI, Steve Sue. I'm biased, right? But it is absolutely the best book for LPs that I've read. I read a ton of books on passive investing, and it's not just for rookies. There's sophisticated quality information in the book that helps rookies and veterans alike. It talks about, Steve Sue's been investing for 14 years and talks about the 20 mistakes that he's made and his learnings from it. And the whole point of groups like Left Field Investors is so that you can learn from other people's successes and you can learn from their mistakes. You copy their successes, you avoid their mistakes, and it offers shortcuts. And that's what Left Field Investors is about. And I am so thrilled that when this book comes out, it's just fantastic. So Avoiding Rookie Errors of the Left Field Investor. That's my choice.
I'm awesome. Excited to read that one. That's fantastic. I didn't know about that, Jim. Great.
Yeah, it is really, really good.
Very cool. Very cool. How about you, Paul?
Mine would be The Creature from Jekyll Island by, was it Edward Chancellor? Is that his name? No, I'm thinking of a different one. Edward Griffin. Excuse me. Edward Griffin. So a lot of my philosophy and the way I look at the market isn't necessarily what's in the headlines today or, you know, what somebody said on CNBC. It's more about financial history and understanding where we've been and then kind of applying those lessons to today and what's happening in the real world in real time. So that book does a fantastic job of kind of laying the groundwork for how the Federal Reserve was created and then all the mishaps and all the different events that happened over time and how the Federal Reserve was kind of involved in it. So, you know, obviously with rates plummeting during COVID and then rising and the Fed kind of controlling our money supply and being a separate arm that's independent of the government and kind of being able to do whatever they want to do, they have a lot more power, I think, than even, you know, people that realize they have power know. They drive just some of the history in the past, drive a lot of decisions I make today. So I'd encourage people to read that book to get some perspective.
Yeah, echo that. That's a really good book, and it definitely raises a lot of questions. So good book, definitely timely right now with everything that's going on. Well, very good, guys. Last question, maybe the most valuable. What is your number one key to success?
That one's easy for me. It's, you know, nothing that I've accomplished, I accomplish alone. It is all on the shoulders of somebody else, of other people. And so the number one key to my success is community, a network, people helping me helping others. You know, the more I teach or educate LP investors, the more I personally learn and become a better investor. Left Field Investors has been around for 3 years. I've been doing this type of investing similar to you, Kent, since about 2014 or 15. And my learning has accelerated in the past 3 years, and it is all due to this community and learning from different people, different perspectives. So absolutely, community. I think to be a successful passive investor, LP investor, I do not think you can do it without a network or a community. You just, the power of community is incredible. So my key to success is having a community or belonging to one or several communities. It doesn't have to be Left Field Investors, but if you're an LP, go join a community, because that's where you get the power to become a better investor.
Excellent. How about you, Paul?
Mine would just be being patient, you know, not saying yes to everything and kind of defaulting to no. There's always going to be other opportunities. I found that some people get, you know, shiny object syndrome, and they'll see a deal come across their table. They're interested in passive investing and they've got to get into that deal. That's the first one they see. Let's jump on it, you know? And to me, it's more about staying in the game long-term. So it's about getting an education and looking over the entire continuum of different opportunities that you have and different asset classes and different operators or whatever it might be, but sort of, you know, hitting singles and doubles and not swinging for the fences, because staying in the game is the number one objective. So I'd say just being patient, waiting for the right deal. You're going to know if you look at enough deals what a good deal looks like. So don't be just lulled into the first one you see.
Yeah, I had a good mentor when I was first starting, coming out of being a passive investor and starting to actively look at doing my own deals, and gave me advice, great advice I'll never forget. And it was basically, you know, when you're first starting to look, right, you spend so much time underwriting that you're just emotionally attached. And he was like, it's not that good of a deal for X, Y, Z reason. And like, I was bummed, you know, because I'd spent a long time on it. And he goes, look, the best way to get over this deal is go look at 100 more, because there's 100 more out there. So go underwrite 100 deals and then come back to me and tell me if you still think this is a good deal. And it was some of the best advice I ever got, because you're right. You do have a tendency as you dig in, I think, to get emotionally attached, but there's always a better deal out there. There's always another deal out there, even when you don't think one's going to come. And you really have to look at hundreds of deals to really know what a good deal is. And I think perspective is super important. And I think you can get that from community, you can get that from experience. But you know, you need that collective had seen 100 deals to really know what's good and what's not. So, well, that's a good place to round it out, guys. I think as we kind of bring it back home, I know there's people that are listening are going to be interested. They're going to be interested in Left Field. They're going to be interested in InvestWise, Collective. How can they get a hold of you guys or learn more about what you're working on?
If you're interested in Left Field Investors, you can reach out to me personally, jim@leftfieldinvestors.com, or you can go to our website, leftfieldinvestors.com, and there's ways to connect and join the community if that's of interest.
Yeah, and InvestWise Collective, you can visit our website at investwisecollective.com. And then I'm pretty easily accessible. on LinkedIn as well. I'd like to network there. So please check me out there and we can connect.
Awesome. Well, thank you guys so much for coming on the show. Thank you for bringing value. Thank you for giving us some unique perspectives. And I hope you both have a great rest of the day.
Thank you, Kent.
Thank you, Kent.
Thanks for listening to another great episode of Ritter on Real Estate. Hit the subscribe button to make sure you don't miss out on the content that will make you a better investor. Also, visit kentritter.com for articles, videos, and tools curated just for passive investors. Until next time, this is Kent Ritter with Ritter on Real Estate. Now go out and invest like a pro.